Chapter 1, Introduction to Flight Training. The primary objective of this chapter is to briefly discuss the knowledges and skills required of a safe and proficient pilot and the physiological factors associated with flight. Flight training, if it is to be truly effective, involves more than learning the mechanical manipulation of an airplane's flight controls. Physical or mental skill alone is not enough. Operational knowledge and understanding of the associated elements are particularly essential in flying, where safety is the most important factor. The more the pilot understands the principles of flying, how to apply those principles in performing maneuvers, and how the maneuvers relate to pertinent pilot operations, the more competent that person will be as a pilot. Ground instruction, whether in a formal or informal classroom, and flight training go hand in hand. Each complements the other and results in a training program which is more meaningful and comprehensive. This handbook is based on the premise that knowledge and understanding, as well as skill, are essential to safety in flight. The instructor and student relationship. The primary purpose of all flight training is to develop safe, proficient pilots. The instructor expects from the student total cooperation and maximum effort toward this objective. Learning to do something well normally involves a high degree of interest and the inner urge or drive to succeed. It makes little difference whether this interest and drive is spontaneous or a result of persuasion, but without some degree of ambition, it is probable that both teaching and learning, even in an endeavor as interesting as flying, will at times become burdensome. The indifferent or irresponsive student pilot who expects to slide effortlessly through the training program simply because it's the instructor's job to teach exhibits a poor attitude toward the task. Those who resent or refuse to accept constructive criticism, or who continually make excuses or blame others for all their problems, are lacking in the attitudes necessary for effective learning. In all flight training, strong motivation and positive attitudes are essential ingredients to assure reaching the objectives. During the training period, the instructor will explain each lesson before the flight. This explanation will include what will be done, why it should be done, and how it should be done. Any point that is not clear should be questioned. By asking questions on the ground, considerable time can be saved for in-flight instruction. An unanswered question in the student's mind can seriously interfere with progress. Questions should be asked even at the expense of appearing ignorant. Pilots with years of experience and thousands of flying hours are still asking questions and still learning. After each flight, the instructor will review the day's lesson. This is the student's chance to clear up any mistaken ideas about each element of a procedure or maneuver. It is imperative that a complete understanding be attained so that corrective action can be taken if necessary. The time to clarify any misconceptions is immediately after the flight, when any problems are still fresh in the person's mind. The FAA certificated flight instructor had to meet broad flying experience requirements, pass rigid written and flight tests, and demonstrate the ability to apply recommended teaching techniques before being certificated. In addition, the flight instructor's certificate must be renewed every 24 months by showing continued success in training pilots, or by satisfactorily completing a flight instructor's refresher course, or a flight check designed to upgrade aeronautical knowledge, pilot proficiency, and teaching techniques. The role of the FAA. The FAA prescribes, through federal aviation regulations, the requirements which must be met before a person is certificated as a pilot. These requirements include the applicant's physical condition, aeronautical experience, knowledge, and skill. The FAA designates selected physicians or aviation medical examiners to conduct initial and periodic physical examinations and issue medical certificates as evidence that the pilot meets the medical standards appropriate to the class of pilot certificate. Federal Aviation Regulations, Part 61, prescribe the minimum aeronautical experience required for each grade of pilot certificate or rating. Flight time consisting of both dual instruction and solo flying are indicative of the pilot's training and experience. All flight time required for certificates or ratings must be recorded and attested to in the pilot's logbook or other reliable record as evidence that the flight training and experience have been acquired. Regulations also prescribe the areas of aeronautical knowledge required for pilot certification. Written tests to assure that the applicants meet the required aeronautical knowledge standards for certification must be passed. The practical application of that knowledge to typical flight situations is emphasized in the written tests. Regulations also prescribe the pilot operations in which proficiency is required for various pilot certificates or ratings. A pilot operation is a group of procedures and maneuvers involving skills and knowledges necessary to safely and efficiently function as a pilot. During a certification flight check, an applicant must demonstrate a satisfactory level of skill in the required pilot operations as outlined in the FAA flight test guides. The maneuvers and procedures used to demonstrate skill in the pilot operations are described in this handbook. The ability of an applicant for an FAA private or commercial pilot certificate to perform the required pilot operations is based on the following. 1. Executing procedures and maneuvers within the aircraft's performance capabilities and limitations, including use of the aircraft's systems. 2. Executing emergency procedures and maneuvers appropriate to the aircraft. 3. Piloting the aircraft with smoothness and accuracy. 4. Exercising judgment. 5. Applying aeronautical knowledge. And 6. Showing that the applicant is the master of the aircraft with the successful outcome of a procedure or maneuver never seriously in doubt. Pilot flight checks are administered by FAA inspectors or by FAA-designated pilot examiners in the aviation industry. The FAA considers the qualifications and performance skills of the pilots to be vital to the safety of all flight operations. All modern advances in aircraft and aircraft equipment intended to improve efficiency and safe operation are futile if the pilot is unqualified or unable to use the equipment effectively. Consequently, the certification flight tests are designed to evaluate the pilot's abilities with regard to safe and efficient pilot performance. Because evaluation through flight tests is a mere sampling of pilot ability and is compressed into a short period of time, much reliance must be placed on the flight instructor to demand proper performance throughout the entire period of training. Practical questions and problems in the FAA tests confine their coverage primarily to considerations which have a direct application to safety. The flight tests are designed to evaluate an applicant's ability to prepare for a flight, maneuver an aircraft safely, plan and execute cross-country flights, and use radio navigation and communication procedures as necessary. All this is important if the pilot is to fit into the modern national airspace system. To safeguard the lives and property of the flying public as well as the non-flying public, regulatory control must be maintained over the operation of all aircraft. Without regulations for flying, confusion would prevail in the national airspace. Federal Aviation Regulations, Part 91, contain the basic safety rules which govern flying in the United States. Every rule, every requirement, every obligation has only one main purpose: safety. Factors attributable to many of the aircraft accidents can be traced to failure to adhere to certain rules of flight and good operating practices. In a democratic society, individuals must accept certain limitations for the general welfare of society. Limitations in the form of regulations and operating procedures are accepted in aviation to make flying safer for everybody and to permit expansion and development of aviation. Therefore, it is imperative that all pilots have a good working knowledge of FAR Part 1. Definitions and abbreviations. Part 61. Certification, Pilots and Flight Instructors, and Part 91, General Operating and Flight Rules, as well as their amendments as soon as they are published. Throughout the nation, the Federal Aviation Administration has approximately 85 General Aviation District offices, often referred to as GADOs. It is through these offices that grassroots contact is provided between the FAA and the aviation community. The general aviation inspectors in those offices are professionally trained, highly competent airmen, and are there to serve the aviation public. They are prepared to advise and assist in any way possible on aviation matters, particularly flight safety. The locations of these offices are convenient to most people and are usually found on or adjacent to an airport. The GADO inspectors make periodic visits to outlying cities within their districts for the purpose of administering written tests and flight tests, as well as conducting flight safety seminars for the aviation public. Study material. If good study habits are to be fully effective, the pilot in training must consider the nature and sources of information. Hangar flying, while an impressive and pleasant pastime from which some information may be gained, is a poor means for resolving problems and gaining knowledge. All too often, exaggerated tales of wild experiences or war stories are related merely to impress the less experienced pilot. Frequently, such sources of information reflect subjective opinions and personal prejudices of those least qualified to give sound advice. The instructor is usually the student's prime reference source, but all pilots should obtain and use appropriate reference texts, manuals, handbooks, periodicals, technical releases, etc. The FAA develops and makes available to the public various sources of aeronautical information, some free, others at a nominal fee. Of particular interest and value to those persons getting their start in flying are the Student Pilot Guide, VFR-IFR Examograms, Pilot's Handbook of Aeronautical Knowledge, Airman's Information Manual, and the Private Pilot Flight Test Guide, in addition to this flight training handbook. Also, there are several excellent commercially produced reference books and audiovisual aids. All of these, however, should be used only under the personal guidance of an instructor. High on all the lists of reference material should be the FAA-approved airplane flight manual or the pilot's operating handbook issued for the airplane being flown. It will prove beneficial to all pilots to acquire a basic aeronautical reference library and to study or review specific topics from time to time. The FAA issues advisory circulars to provide a systematic means for the issuance of non-regulatory material for the guidance and information of the aviation public. These circulars contain an explanation of various subjects of interest and importance to all pilots. They are issued in a numbered subject system corresponding to the subject areas in the Federal Aviation Regulations. This makes it easy to locate both regulations and advisory material which the FAA has issued on any subject. Most of these circulars are available free of charge and can be obtained individually or by having one's name placed on FAA's mailing list for future circulars. Others may be purchased for a small fee. Complete listings and instructions for ordering are contained in the latest issue of Advisory Circular 00-2, Aviation Circular Checklist, which can be obtained from the U.S. Department of Transportation Publications Section, M443.1, Washington, D.C., 20590. Study habits. Learning to fly, like all other learning, should be approached one step at a time. It is a waste of time to study advanced maneuvers before becoming familiar with the basic maneuvers. A training syllabus should be followed, and each lesson studied in progression. Each step must be understood in proper sequence in order to avoid waste of time and money. Good study habits include the practice of visualizing the instructor's explanation and those of the textbook. In addition to reading the text, a clear mind's eye picture should be developed in terms of airplane attitude, reaction, and performance. Study, especially as it pertains to learning to fly, is the development of precise, meaningful images in the mind. Good study habits in pilot training also include time spent in the cockpit reviewing checklists, identifying controls, and learning the cockpit arrangement. The more familiar a pilot is with the airplane and its equipment, the more time can be devoted to precise airplane control. Lack of familiarity with the airplane is the cause of a high percentage of pilot error accidents. Incomplete knowledge of aircraft equipment, systems, and capabilities often results in improper use of emergency systems, hard or gear-up landings, undershooting or overshooting the runway, fuel exhaustion, stalls, spins, etc. In a very real sense, such accidents are the direct result of poor study habits. ground safety. A high percentage of accidents in aviation occur during ground operations of aircraft and equipment. Failure to observe rules of safety is certain to cause problems. The old saying that safety is no accident is more than a cliché, it's an axiom. Observance of common sense rules is generally sufficient, but there is little chance that pilots will comply with rules, however reasonable, if they are not sincerely concerned with safety. Pilots should be familiar with safety measures relative to fire and contamination hazards during fuel servicing, precautions for walking on parking ramps in close proximity to aircraft, taxiing and parking aircraft, entering and leaving aircraft, and pre- and post-flight procedures, such as the positioning of switches and controls, the use of tie-downs, and the proper installation of fuel and oil tank filler caps, etc. It is recommended that a checklist which includes pre-flight, in-flight, and post-flight operation, including emergency procedures, be immediately available and constantly used. Checking important items by rote is not an acceptable substitute for checklists. Many of the items which should be checked will be covered in more detail later in this handbook. A flight training program that ignores or only pays lip service to ground safety is lacking in one of the elements requisite to good training. Flight safety. The most conscientious pre-flight planning and careful compliance with ground safety rules will in no way compensate for a lackadaisical attitude toward safety in flight. Since safety in flight relates to a great many things, no attempt will be made to cover them all in this chapter. There are, however, certain practices relative to flight safety that must be stressed at this time. Good habits established early and continually reinforced throughout a training program are habits that the pilot is likely to follow faithfully throughout his or her flying career. When operating in the seemingly limitless space of the sky, it is easy to forget that many other aircraft are flying in today's airspace, especially in airport traffic patterns and along busy airways. The pilot must maintain a continuous vigilance for other aircraft around, above, and below. Though a pilot may have a high degree of skill in aircraft control, excellent coordination, and faultless execution of pilot operations, when one fails to maintain a constant and careful watch for other aircraft, that person is a dangerous pilot, dangerous not only to oneself, but to passengers and all others in the immediate vicinity. Safe operating limitations. Every pilot should be thoroughly familiar with the operating limitations or capabilities applicable to the airplane and its equipment. There can be little excuse for accidents that result from failure to observe or be aware of the airplane's flight limitations. A complete understanding of the pertinent FAA-approved airplane flight manual or the pilot's operating handbook is important. Just as important as the airplane's limitations are the pilot's limitations. One cannot operate safely if the pilot exceeds his or her own capabilities. These are learned only through training and experience and an honest evaluation of one's knowledge and proficiency as well as physical condition. Aeromedical factors. This section is not intended to be an in-depth discussion of all the aeromedical factors with which pilots must be concerned. However, the sooner the pilot learns that at least a basic knowledge of these matters is vital to safe flight operations, the sooner adequate attention will be devoted to learning more about aeromedical problems. Once the pilot enters the airplane, the ability to function properly is absolutely essential to safe flight. Ignorance of and indifference to the physical demands of flight can be as senseless as the lack of concern for an airplane's structural integrity. It is the responsibility of the pilot to consider the status of his or her personal health and to be informed on aeromedical facts. Advisory Circular 67-2, Medical Handbook for Pilots, provides much of this information. A few of the more important medical factors dealing with a pilot's ability to safely function in the flight environment and to cope with its problems are briefly discussed here as an introduction to beginning pilots. General health. The person who, for whatever reason, does not feel well should not attempt to participate as a pilot in flying activities. General discomfort, whether due to colds, indigestion, nausea, overwork, lack of sleep, worry, or any other bodily weakness, is not conducive to safe flying. Perhaps the most insidious and common of all conditions that can result in dangerous inattentiveness, slow reactions, and confused mental processes is excessive fatigue. Marked fatigue is as valid a reason for canceling or postponing a flight as an engine which is found unacceptable during an operations check. Self-medication can be a very hazardous undertaking for pilots. Probably the best general recommendation for flyers is abstinence from all drugs when flying is anticipated. In some instances, the need for a particular drug or medication is an indication that the pilot's health is such that flying is automatically precluded. In other cases, it is unlikely that a pilot who is ill enough to require a drug would be well enough to fly by the time the chance of toxicity from the drug has disappeared. Antihistamines, tranquilizers, reducing pills, barbiturates, nerve tonics, and many other over-the-counter drugs can be lethal to the pilot in flight. It is best for those in doubt about such medication to consult a doctor, preferably an FAA-designated aviation medical examiner. FAA's Guide to Drug Hazards in Aviation Medicine, Advisory Circular 91.11-1, is available through the Superintendent of Documents, U.S. Government Printing Office, and is recommended for those who are interested in more complete information on this subject. The FAA Airman's Information Manual includes additional discussions on pilot error medical factors. All pilots should be aware that regulations forbid any person from acting as a flight crew member while using any drug that affects the person's faculties in any way contrary to safety. Hypoxia. In simple terms, hypoxia is the result of insufficient oxygen in the bloodstream. Many are prone to associate hypoxia only with flight at high altitude. While it is true that there is a progressive decrease of oxygen with an increase in altitude, there are many other conditions or situations which can and do interfere with the blood's ability to carry oxygen to the brain. Many drugs, alcohol, and heavy smoking will either diminish the blood's ability to absorb oxygen or the ability of the brain to tolerate hypoxia. Because of wide individual variations in susceptibility to hypoxia, it is impossible to predict exactly when, where, or how hypoxia reactions will occur in each pilot. As a general rule, however, flights below 10,000 feet MSL without the use of supplemental oxygen can be considered safe, though night vision is particularly critical and impairment of sight can occur at lower altitudes, especially for heavy smokers. The onset of hypoxia is insidious and progresses slowly. Impaired reactions, confused thinking, poor judgment, unusual fatigue, and dull headaches are typical reactions. Sometimes there is a sense of well-being characterized by high spirits or by the feeling that things could not be better, or euphoria. But the individual thus involved may have little, if any, insight into his or her actual condition. Because of this, and because many pilots never experience this false, happy, carefree feeling, it is not always a symptom one can rely upon to warn of an active or incipient hypoxic condition. Hyperventilation. Hyperventilation is simply a matter of breathing too rapidly. This condition probably occurs with greater frequency among student pilots than is generally recognized. It is seldom completely incapacitating, but it does produce one or more of the symptoms noted later that are disturbing if not alarming to the uninformed pilot. Therefore, it only aggravates the problem by further increasing anxiety and thus the breathing rate. Under conditions of stress and anxiety, a person's body reacts automatically to such stimuli, whether the danger be imaginary or real. One of these automatic reactions is a marked increase in breathing rate. This results in a significant decrease in the carbon dioxide content of the blood. Carbon dioxide, of course, is needed to automatically regulate the breathing process. The common symptoms of this condition are dizziness, nausea, hot and cold sensations, tingling of the hands, legs, and feet, sleepiness, and finally unconsciousness. Many of these symptoms are also common to hypoxia and some to ordinary air sickness. It may be that many students who feel dizzy, lightheaded, or grow nauseated on their early flights are suffering from hyperventilation as well as from motion sickness. Both students and instructors should be aware of this possibility. This condition can be relieved by consciously slowing the breathing rate. Talking loudly or breathing into a bag to restore carbon dioxide will effectively slow the breathing rate. Alcohol. There is only one safe rule to follow with respect to combining flying and drinking. Don't. Alcohol consumed by a person is metabolized at a fixed rate by the body. This rate is not altered by the use of coffee or other popular quack remedies. Hangovers, whether masked by aspirin or other medication, are included in the preceding admonition about flying. Recent medical investigations of general aviation accidents indicate that alcohol has been a factor in a significant number of aircraft accidents. The inherent danger in drinking and flying apparently has not impressed some pilots. Possibly they labor under the deadly delusion that flying after a few drinks is no more dangerous than driving while in the same condition. Even this would be a false assumption, since drinking is involved in about half the fatal auto accidents investigated. We must first accept two simple truths. First, flying an airplane is more complex than the two-dimensional demands of driving a car. Second, increased altitude multiplies the intoxicating effect of alcohol on the body. For all practical purposes, only the brain gets drunk. When a person drinks an alcoholic beverage, the alcohol begins immediately to pass from the stomach to the bloodstream. 2 ounces of bourbon will be absorbed by the bloodstream in 10 minutes, 4 ounces in 30 minutes, and 8 ounces in 1.5 hours. The alcohol is carried by the bloodstream to all parts of the body with varying effects, but the brain is really affected the most. Alcohol numbs the brain in the area where our thinking takes place, then proceeds to the area that controls ordinary body movements. Coordination is affected. Eyes fail to focus, and hands lose their dexterity. Any pilot who flies within 8 hours after the consumption of alcoholic beverages, or while under the influence of alcohol, is not only dangerous, but is in violation of federal aviation regulations. Carbon monoxide. Carbon monoxide, always present in fumes from the internal combustion engine, is a colorless, tasteless, and odorless gas. Even minute quantities breathed over a long period of time can have serious consequences. Its effects can be cumulative and are not easily corrected. A breath of fresh air will not bring early relief. Several days may be required to completely rid the body of carbon monoxide. This gas has the ability to saturate the blood's hemoglobin and prevent the absorption of oxygen. The brain and body tissue must have oxygen to function and survive. Aircraft heaters, designed to utilize the heat of engine exhaust gases, are the usual source for this insidious danger. Be wary if there is a smell of exhaust fumes, especially if mental confusion, dizziness, uneasiness, or headaches follow. If such symptoms develop, shut off the cabin heater, ventilate the cabin to the maximum extent possible, descend to lower altitudes where the need for heat is less critical, and land as soon as possible for a thorough check of the source of the trouble. It is wise to then consult a doctor. Remember, it may take several days to rid the body of carbon monoxide. Though there are several types of relatively inexpensive detectors available today which may warn of unsafe conditions with respect to carbon monoxide in the cabin, they may not always be completely reliable, and their use should not lull one into a sense of false security. Middle ear discomfort or pain. Certain persons, whether pilots or passengers, have difficulty balancing the air loads on the eardrum while descending. This is particularly troublesome if a head cold or throat inflammation keeps the eustachian tube from opening properly. If this trouble occurs during descent, the person should try swallowing, yawning, or holding the nose and mouth shut and forcibly exhaling. If no relief occurs, it may be best to climb back up a few thousand feet to relieve the pressure on the outer drum. Then a descent should be made using these same measures. A more gradual descent may be tried, and it may be necessary to go through several climbs and descents to stair-step down. If a nasal inhaler is available, it may afford some relief. If trouble persists several hours after landing, an aviation medical examiner should be consulted. Disorientation or vertigo. The flight attitude of an airplane is generally determined by reference to the natural horizon. When the natural horizon is obscured, attitude can sometimes be maintained by reference to the surface below. If neither horizon nor surface references exist, the airplane's attitude must be determined by artificial means, an attitude indicator or other flight instruments. Sight, supported by other senses such as the inner ear and muscle sense, is used to maintain spatial orientation. However, during periods of low visibility, the supporting senses sometimes conflict with what is seen. When this happens, a pilot is particularly vulnerable to spatial disorientation. The degree of disorientation may vary considerably with individual pilots, as do the conditions which induce the problem. Spatial disorientation to a pilot means simply the inability to tell which way is up. Surface references or the natural horizon may at times become obscured by smoke, fog, smog, haze, dust, ice particles, or other phenomenon, although visibility may be above visual flight rule or VFR minimums. This is especially true at airports located adjacent to large bodies of water or sparsely populated areas where few, if any, surface references are available. Lack of horizon or surface reference is common on overwater flights, at night, or in low visibility conditions. Other contributors to disorientation are reflections from outside lights, sunlight shining through clouds, and light beams from the airplane's anti-collision rotating beacon. The following are certain basic steps which should assist materially in preventing spatial disorientation. 1. Before flying with less than 3 miles visibility, obtain training and maintain proficiency in airplane control by reference to instruments. 2. When flying at night or in reduced visibility, use the flight instruments. 3. Maintain night currency if intending to fly at night. Include cross-country and local operations at different airports. 4. Study and become familiar with unique geographical conditions in areas in which the flight is intended. 5. Check weather forecasts before departure, en route, and at destination. Be alert for weather deterioration. 6. Do not attempt visual flight when there is a possibility of getting trapped in deteriorating weather. And 7. Rely on instrument indications unless the natural horizon or surface reference is clearly visible. Motion sickness. Although motion sickness is uncommon among experienced pilots, it does occur occasionally. A person who has been its victim knows how uncomfortable it is. Most important, it jeopardizes the pilot's flying efficiency, particularly in turbulent weather and in instrument conditions when peak skill is required. Student pilots are frequently surprised by an uneasiness, usually described as motion sickness. This is probably a result of a combination of anxiety, unfamiliarity, and the vibration or jogging received from the airplane, and usually is overcome with experience. Motion sickness is caused by continued stimulation of the tiny portion of the inner ear which controls the pilot's sense of balance. The symptoms are progressive. First, the desire for food is lost. Then saliva collects in the mouth and the person begins to perspire freely. Eventually, he or she becomes nauseated and disoriented. The head aches and there may be a tendency to vomit. If the air sickness becomes severe enough, the pilot may become completely incapacitated. Pilots who are susceptible to air sickness should not take the preventative drugs which are available over the counter or by prescription. These medications may make a person drowsy or depress his or her brain function in other ways. Careful research has shown that most motion sickness drugs cause a temporary deterioration of navigational skills or other tasks demanding keen judgment. If suffering from air sickness while piloting an aircraft,
open up the air vents, loosen the clothing, use supplemental oxygen, and keep the eyes on a point outside the airplane. Avoid unnecessary head movements, then cancel the flight and land as soon as possible.